Despite President Donald Trump's proposal to take over the Gaza Strip, Palestinians say they don't want to leave.
God is greater than Trump and America and Israel. We will not emigrate. We are steadfast on our land. They destroyed our houses and killed our children, but we are steadfast.
We visit a hospital in Goma, in the eastern DRC, now that the fighting has subsided.
C'est juste derrière ici que là la bombe est tombée.
It was just behind here that the shell landed. Otherwise, just a few meters closer to the incubators, we could have had a tragedy involving those children.
And what exactly is Elon Musk doing with the U.S. government?
We're trying to shrink government, and he can probably shrink it as well as anybody else, if not better.
Today is February 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. When President Trump announced this week his plan for the U.S. to redevelop Gaza into the Riviera of the Middle East, he also said the approximately 1.8 million Palestinians living there would be better off someplace new. The Gazans, however, are not interested in leaving their homes.
Even in the face of a winter storm, they pitch tents atop the rubble, determined not to be moved. Meanwhile, the Israeli defense minister is making plans for what he calls their, quote, voluntary departure. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Despite heavy wind, rains, and fears of expulsion, Gazans said on Thursday they were more determined than ever to stay put. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz ordered the army to prepare a plan to allow for the, quote, voluntary departure of residents from Gaza. A day after US President Donald Trump announced plans to seize the enclave and expel them, those plans drew worldwide condemnation. And rights groups warned they'd amount to ethnic cleansing. Displaced Gazan Wael al-Mamluk.
God is greater than Trump and America and Israel. We will not emigrate. We are steadfast on our land. They destroyed our houses and killed our children, but we are steadfast.
Trump said on Thursday on his Truth Social platform that Israel would hand Gaza to the United States after fighting was over, and the enclave's population was resettled elsewhere, which he said meant no US troops would be needed on the ground. Regional heavyweight and US ally Saudi Arabia rejected the proposal outright. Jordan's King Abdullah, who will meet Trump at the White House next week, said on Wednesday he rejected any attempts to annex land and displace Palestinians. Displacement of the Palestinians is one of the Middle East's most sensitive issues. Forced or coerced displacement of a population under military occupation is a war crime, banned under the Geneva Conventions.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting.
The Asia-Pacific region is another diplomatic hotspot for the United States and the world. Looking to strengthen ties, Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba will meet President Trump at the White House on Friday. Japanese officials say they want to reaffirm the U.S.-Japan alliance and build strong personal ties between Ishiba and Trump. VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Since starting his second term, U.S. President Donald Trump has quickly reapplied pressure on countries he says are exploiting the United States.
They're coming in and they're stealing our wealth, they're stealing our jobs, they're stealing our companies.
That pressure extends to U.S. friends, with Trump threatening tariffs and even suggesting taking Greenland and making Canada the 51st U.S. state. That is the context for Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba's first meeting with Trump on Friday. And it's worrying many in Tokyo, says Professor Jeffrey J. Hall.
If you watch Japanese media or you listen to what Japanese people say, they're just hoping that Ishiba can get out of this meeting without becoming a victim of some kind of new attack from America.
During Donald Trump's first term, U.S.-Japan tensions were tempered, partly because of the personal diplomacy of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. But that approach may be difficult for Ishiba, who has a much different personality, according to Hall.
He's a kind of academic guy. He likes to just explain in excruciating detail, which can be good in a parliamentary debate or in some other setting. But when it comes to Trump, it's the polar opposite of the kind of conversation that Trump likes to have.
Some in Japan question why Ishiba is meeting Trump right now at all. Instead, they ask, why not stay off Trump's radar as long as possible? Others argue it's better to be proactive, in part to protect against any future strains in the alliance. Miyako Nakabayashi is a former Japanese lawmaker.
Some people say that don't wake up sleeping baby. But you have to take a risk if you want to have a better relationship.
It's the same dynamic facing virtually every U.S. ally as Trump again pursues his America First approach to the world. Bill Gallo, BOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
We've reported before about the violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo around the city of Goma. Congolese forces fought the M23 rebel group, which is backed by neighboring Rwanda. It's an allegation Kigali denies. The fighting has subsided for now, but the scars and the bullet holes remain. Veda Chan of Reuters takes us to the Charité Maternelle Hospital in Goma.
Walking through the halls of a hospital in Democratic Republic of Congo's Goma, Dr. Jules Cafetier points out the damage from the conflict between M23 rebels and Congolese forces.
It was just behind here that the shell landed. Otherwise, just a few meters closer to the incubators, we could have had a tragedy involving those children.
Cafetier is the director of the Charité Maternelle Hospital. He says shells or bombs fell on the roof of the neonatal unit, damaging the roof and solar panels. Another room suffered roof damage as well. He says bullets or shrapnels destroyed the walls there. If someone had been there, they would have died, he said. The United Nations estimates at least 2,800 people have died in recent fighting around Goma. Congo accuses Rwanda of using M23 to pillage valuable mineral deposits. Rwanda says it is acting in self-defense and to protect the ethnic Tutsis. On Wednesday, the Rwandan-backed rebels took control of another town in eastern Congo, despite the unilateral ceasefire they declared earlier this week. The advance could indicate M23 has renewed a push towards Bukavu.
That's Veda Chan of Reuters reporting.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
North Korean ballistic missiles fired at Ukraine by Russian forces since late December have been far more precise than previous salvos of the weapons launched over the past year. This according to two senior Ukrainian officials who spoke to Reuters. The increase in accuracy to within 50 meters of the intended target suggests that knowledge gained from the battlefield in Ukraine is helping North Korea further develop its missile technology, said one of the sources. North Korea's military technology has developed rapidly in recent years, including short and intermediate-range missiles that Pyongyang says can be tipped with nuclear warheads. Until its involvement in Ukraine, however, the long-isolated nation has never tested the new weapons in combat.
Greece has declared a state of emergency on Santorini after hundreds of undersea earthquakes shook the resort island for nearly a week. The Ministry of Civil Protection's announcement on Thursday will provide authorities faster access to state resources. It follows a magnitude 5.8 tremor that struck late Wednesday, the most powerful recorded since activity started on January 31st. Despite causing minimal damage, the earthquakes have prompted the evacuation of thousands of residents and seasonal workers.
A fourth contingent of Kenyan police arrived in Haiti Thursday to help repel violent gangs. This as officials brushed off concerns of a halt in some U.S. funding to the UN-backed mission. The 200 Kenyan police officers on Thursday joined more than 600 others already there, alongside Haiti's national police as part of a multinational force that includes soldiers and police deployed from Jamaica, Guatemala, and El Salvador. The latest deployment of Kenyan police comes 2 days after the U.S. notified the UN that it was freezing $13.3 million slated for the mission. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. The intersection of American politics and human rights is in the spotlight again as President Donald Trump continues to follow through on campaign promises to roll back protections and rights for transgender Americans. On Wednesday, he signed an executive order banning transgender girls and women from playing in women's sports at federally funded schools.
The NCAA, the following day, changed its policy on transgender athletes, announcing that competition in women's sports will be limited to athletes assigned the female gender at birth. The executive order is also expected to put pressure on the International Olympic Committee to follow suit.
Republicans say the ban restores fairness and promotes safety, but critics say it tramples on the rights of a small minority of athletes. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
From now on, women's sports will be only for women. President Donald Trump on Wednesday signed an executive order to exclude transgender girls and women from participating in female school sports under his interpretation of Title IX. Reuters correspondent Dan Trotta explains.
Title IX is a law that prevents discrimination on the basis of sex in education. The Trump administration intends to use Title IX as a means to protect women in sports, that is, non-transgender women in sports, to protect them from having to compete against transgender athletes. That's where there could be a true change in policy if it holds up in court.
With my action this afternoon, we're putting every school receiving taxpayer dollars on notice that if you let men take over women's sports teams or invade your locker rooms, you will be investigated for violations of Title IX and risk your federal funding. There will be no federal funding.
Critics say Trump's directive stomps on the rights of a small minority of athletes, but Republicans say the directive restores fairness in sports and protects girls in schools.
So it's something of an open question, but the real issue, as the president of the NCAA said, is that there are less than 10 transgender athletes among the 500,000 participating in collegiate sports. At the high school level, it's impossible to say exactly, but the best estimates are that there are a couple of dozen.
The war on women's sports is over.
Trump's order also instructs the State Department to demand changes within the International Olympic Committee to prevent transgender athletes from competing.
Trump cannot dictate to the International Olympic Committee what its rules ought to be. And this is a matter that has undergone some serious review multiple times by the Olympic Committee.
The Trump administration has taken aim broadly at transgender rights since taking office on January 20th. While Trump supporters have hailed the president for making good on campaign promises, critics say Trump has overstepped his executive authority.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reporting for us today.
President Trump's point person for making rapid changes at U.S. governmental agencies is Elon Musk. The chief executive of carmaker Tesla and aerospace company SpaceX, he's also the richest person in the world and oversees billions of dollars in government contracts with his various businesses.
Congressional Democrats say that Musk's access to financial information is wrong and that someone who was not elected by the public or confirmed by the Senate should not have so much power in Washington. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
A protest outside a federal agency in Washington this week focused on the work of Elon Musk, President Donald Trump's designee for shrinking the U.S. government. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy.
The people get to decide how we defend the United States of America. The people get to decide how their taxpayer money is spent. Elon Musk does not get to decide.
Musk is the world's richest man, and the chief executive of electric vehicle firm Tesla and aerospace company SpaceX. He also owns other companies, including the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter. Since Trump's inauguration, Musk, as the leader of the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has gotten down to work cutting what he and President Trump see as costly federal programs.
We will win! We will win!
Musk's team has reportedly gained access to the Treasury Department's payment systems, raising alarms, and has sought control of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which provides humanitarian and other aid to more than 100 countries. That's where the protests happened this week. Democratic Representative Don Beyer.
President Trump directed his corrupt billionaire friend, Elon Musk, to ransack a critical agency of the U.S. government.
Trump, however, reiterated his support for Musk.
It's something that he feels very strongly about, and I'm impressed because he's running, obviously, a big company.
Elon Musk said what he discovered at USAID isn't salvageable.
As we dug into USAID, it became apparent that what we have here is not an apple with a worm in it, but we have actually just a ball of worms.
Congressional Democrats dispute that and say it is wrong that Musk has so much power and little accountability and oversight, especially given that SpaceX has contracts with the federal government. Democratic Senator Patty Murray.
an unelected, unaccountable billionaire with expansive conflicts of interest, deep ties to China, and an indiscreet axe to grind against perceived enemies, is hijacking our nation's most sensitive financial data systems and its checkbook.
But Trump says that the White House is providing the necessary oversight to Musk's work.
Where we think there's a conflict or there's a problem, we won't let him go near it. But we're trying to shrink government, and he can probably shrink it as well as anybody else, if not better.
In his unpaid role as a special government employee, Musk is permitted to work no more than 130 days a year. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
In a late-breaking development on Thursday in Washington, it was announced that President Trump's administration will keep fewer than 300 out of the more than 10,000 staff members of USAID.
Washington's primary humanitarian aid agency has been a target of the Department of Government Efficiency, led by Elon Musk, since Trump took office on January 20th. Four sources familiar with the plan told Reuters that only 294 agency staff members out of 10,000 would be able to keep their jobs. Trump and Musk have levied unproven claims that USAID staff were criminals and that funds were stolen. Dozens of USAID staff have been put on leave. Hundreds of internal contractors have been laid off, leaving life-saving programs around the globe in limbo.
We've reported on the show before about the humanitarian work USAID has been carrying out in Haiti, Ukraine, and in parts of Africa that have been affected by interruptions in funding. Today, we take a look at South Asia. Trump's move to freeze most foreign aid has brought healthcare services to a halt at refugee camps on the Thai-Myanmar border, forcing seriously ill residents to turn to government facilities for treatment. Fiona Jones reports.
A group of Thai medics battled to save the life of elderly Myanmar refugee Adabi as her daughter looked on tearfully. Previously, the US-funded International Rescue Committee would have treated her and the tens of thousands of other refugees living in camps on the Thai-Myanmar border. But President Donald Trump's freeze on most foreign aid has forced seriously ill patients like Adabi to rely on Thailand's state-run facilities instead. Thawachai Ying Tui Sak is the director of the Ta Song Yang Hospital, where Adabi was revived.
The main care providers at Mae Lai refugee camp are the medics, who are trained for about a year and a half. They have limited capability. They usually have two doctors from IRC at the camp. They are Burmese and can communicate with people. Outside of working hours, there is no access to doctors. The doctors have to go back to Mae Sot. These doctors are more like advising than taking care of patients directly.
He added that her camp had one IRC-run hospital and two clinics to care for about 29,000 people before support was withdrawn. Another patient from the same camp said they don't have money to buy medicine there and they'll all die without it. The refugee crisis on the border with Thailand has intensified due to escalations in the Myanmar civil war over the last 2 years. The loss of foreign aid has left Thai officials and refugee groups scrambling to fill the gap. Last week, the government vowed to support refugee healthcare following the US's aid suspension. But this district's leader said that beyond immediate response, state hospitals may not be able to deal with this long-term burden.
Reuters' Fiona Jones with that story.
Changing gears now, we go to New Zealand, where thousands have gathered across the country on Thursday to celebrate the signing of the country's founding document.
The formal celebrations included a dawn service in the town of Waitangi, marking the day in 1840 when the treaty was first signed between the British Crown and more than 500 Maori chiefs.
Waitangi Day is an important day for us as a nation, Maori nei, Pākehā nei, anywhere in between that as well. This feels like a special place to be, and so it always feels like a real privilege to be here to celebrate, but also to think about the things that, you know, we haven't quite hit yet.
Some Maori rights advocates, however, turned their backs on New Zealand lawmaker David Seymour in protest while he was speaking at Waitangi. Seymour is the author of legislation, the Treaty Principles Bill, that seeks to redefine how the treaty is interpreted.
Relations between the conservative government and Maori have soured in the last 18 months, as the government has unwound policies and disbanded organizations aimed at improving the lives of the Maori, who make up about 20% of the country's 5.3 million people. Tens of thousands of New Zealanders took part in a 9-day march late last year against the Treaty Principles Bill.
Back in the United States, a food bank in the southwestern state of New Mexico is tackling hunger and emergency food needs with a flavorful fundraiser that has local chefs competing for best soup. Gustavo Martinez Contreras is there.
Santa Fe Food Depot Super Bowl was a spoonful of deliciousness where 23 local chefs faced off in a friendly competition to benefit the New Mexico Food Bank. Held each year before the American Football Championship Super Bowl, it's the food bank's biggest fundraiser, which this year brought in more than $100,000. Organizers say that will help provide more than 500,000 meals to children, senior citizens, and families experiencing food insecurity. Executive Director Jill Dixon says hunger is a constant throughout the United States.
So in our view, until everyone is fed, until everyone is sure where their next meal is coming from, our work is not done.
As a first responder organization, Dixon says the Food Depot also helps families displaced by wildfires and floods in New Mexico. More than 1,500 people came out to support the food bank at this year's Super Bowl, where judges chose from five categories: cream, savory, seafood, vegetarian, and best overall. It was a yummy but difficult decision for attendee Richard Bosson.
Well, the Food Depot is well known, does a wonderful job in the community. And yes, it's more important than ever with all the conditions in the country. That's not why I'm here. I'm here for the food, but I'm glad I'm doing a good thing at the same time.
When all the votes were counted, one chef's soup was the cream of the crop. The green chili clam chowder by Flying Tortilla chef Adrian Martinez, an immigrant from Mexico who says he learned to cook in the United States.
Flying Tortilla! Congratulations!
Martinez says he is proud to have won, but it's bittersweet because of the current situation surrounding immigration in the United States. He says migrants come here to grow and to help their families. While the chief goal was raising funds for the Food Depot, organizers say they also wanted to highlight the importance of immigrant workforce in the U.S. food and service industries. Gustavo Martinez Contreras, VOA News, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
There's a unique initiative underway in Cyprus in which scientists have enlisted children to help recycle used cooking oil into biofuel. It's part of a plan that has received international acclaim. As Alice Rizzo of Reuters reports, it's a win-win.
In Cyprus, the frying pan movement is turning household waste into a sustainability lesson. The initiative enlists children to collect used cooking oil from their homes, which is then filtered and turned into biofuel. Led by scientists at the ACTI Project and Research Center, a local environmental NGO, the project aims to teach children that waste can be repurposed. Here is Xenia Luizidu, chair of ACTI.
What the children learn is that they can take a toxic pollutant and make it fuel for their schools to implement green infrastructure, to do their gardens, to do a series of very, very specific green activities. So this is what we want the children to know, that waste is not waste. Waste has value.
Profits are divided among participating schools, and children have the chance to decide which green projects to support. Meanwhile, the collected oil is processed at the Cazoil Waste Management Plant, where it is filtered and sold to international markets as biofuel. Here is Cazoil Managing Director George Moisi.
Cooking oil does have a value, and it can be used for multiple purposes, and it should not end up in the drainage system.
With millions of litres of used cooking oil thrown away each year, clogging drains and polluting underground water, the project offers a simple yet impactful alternative. Backed by Cyprus's Ministry of Education and recognised by the European Commission, it has now become a core part of the national curriculum, engaging over 80,000 students annually.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.